The following podcast is an Embassy Row production.
Hey everybody, I'm Mark Lamont Hill, owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. I am a professor, a scholar, and most importantly, a book nerd. I say book nerd because I don't just love to read books, I'm the person who loves to read about the book. I love hearing authors talk about how and why they wrote the book, and I love talking to other book nerds about their favorite books. That's why I started Coffee and Books. It's a podcast all about books. Every episode, I sit down over a cup of coffee with the world's biggest authors to discuss the most interesting, controversial, fun, or important books. And sometimes I hang out with experts, fans, and other special guests to talk about some of the greatest books of all time. And today is gonna be a fun one. I am joined by Mitchell Plitnick, the man, the myth, the legend, but most importantly, he is the co-author of a wonderful new book called Except for Palestine: The Limits of Progressive Politics. And of course, his co-author is none other than yours truly. That's right. Another podcast from Mark Lamont Hill about a Mark Lamont Hill book. What can I say? I'm pretty transparent about it, though. I am shameless in plugging my books on my own podcast. Mitchell, good to see you.
Good to see you too, man.
Of course, I see you all the time because we not only wrote this book together, but we are now going around talking about this book all the time.
We are.
And so this is kind of a weird podcast because I'm sort of interviewing you and I'm kind of just talking to you about a book that we wrote together. So it's a strange thing to do. I've never done an interview like this before, but we're going to figure it out. But before we talk about the book, let's talk about the coffee. I, in honor of this momentous occasion, am drinking Arabic coffee. What they say in Palestine, they call it Ahwe Arabiya, you know, kind of black Arabic coffee, and we say that, right? Black coffee. You know, some people say, you know, it's the Turkish method. We could have a whole other conversation about what that means. But basically, it's a coffee that is made unfiltered with finely ground coffee beans. I mean, they're ground so fine, sometimes they look like cocoa powder. Mm-hmm. And then they're boiled in a special pot. And then some people put sugar and cardamom and all that stuff. But no, I do it sad that I do it black. And it tastes good. It's powerful. And it keeps me awake. Now, normally I'm much more boring with my coffee, so I don't want to make you feel intimidated by my coffee preferences the way I do with my basketball preferences, me being a Sixers fan and you being a Nets fan. But I will ask you, what kind of coffee are you drinking, sir?
Well, these days, you know, I'm actually kind of on the other end of the spectrum because I'm drinking usually a blonde roast. It's got a little bit of sweetener in it, a little bit of lightener in it. So it's almost on the other end. But I will say, whenever I go over to Palestine and to Israel and to the region, I am always drinking the Arabic coffee and I'm drinking the black.
Yes, there's no other way to have it.
So I need to get one of those little machines so I can have that here too.
You know, I actually bought one in Jerusalem and it was taken from me in the airport many years ago. So I am going to get another one mailed to me from somewhere in the Middle East and I'll make sure you get one too.
That'd be awesome.
And the great thing about coffee, by the way, in the Middle East and especially among the Palestinians is, even if you say you don't want coffee today, if you spend time with anybody, you're going to drink some coffee. Yeah. You go to someone's house, you're drinking coffee. Noon, you're drinking coffee. Come on, I'll just have a cup of tea. The best you might get out of them is if they'll let you drink some tea, you know what I mean, as an alternative. But you ain't going to nobody's house or having any kind of real meeting without coffee and probably finding yourself eating something too. So
yep.
One of the great things about this.
That was the mistake I made the very first time I ever went over there. You know, I went and I was over at a Palestinian home. Well, it wasn't a home. It was actually in outside of Jerusalem, and it was in a garbage dump, and they were living in an abandoned train car. You know, I mean, and they come out with food and give me food, and it was tea actually at that time. And I was just, no, you know, I mean, they had nothing. You know, so my immediate inclination was, right, just to say, no, 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 you keep this for yourself. But they were insisting, no, 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 you are drinking this tea, you are taking this food. And my host who was with me, who was bringing me around at that time, this is going back years, he was bringing me around at that time, he just said, yeah, you're going to take it. They're not going to let you go without eating and drinking. So
I had a very similar experience. I was in Khan al-Ahmar, which is, for those who don't know, it's not far outside of Jerusalem. And it's right in between kind of Jerusalem and in these the settlements. And this is, again, this is a Bedouin, like a village. It was set for demolition at the time. they made a school out of like tires and mud. People are worried about losing everything. And I'm talking to them about what's going on. And after about 15 minutes into this just painful story about loss and being poor and trying to find money, they come out with the coffee pot.
Yeah.
And so, you know, coffee, particularly in Palestinian society, you know, in many ways is one of those mechanisms for creating community, for mm-hmm. showing love, of offering care. And it makes people feel good to be able to offer that. It's part of what it means to be in community. So I'm glad we could talk about that. This is actually the most we've talked about coffee on Coffee and Books, which is kind of fun. We have to do a whole episode on that. But talk to me about this book. People are asking, why write a book on Palestine, you know, except for Palestine, the limits of progressive politics? I guess the first thing I should get you to talk about, because I want you to talk more than me today, is why this book? Why did we do this, Mitchell?
So just to give your listeners a little background, that you and I met actually over there for the first time when the Foundation for Middle East Peace, where I was working at the time, organized a trip for some journalists, and you were one of them, and we went over there. And, you know, we just started talking, and it was, I guess, a couple of years later that we started talking then about doing this book. And as I recall, it was actually a question. We weren't sure what we were exactly going to write about. We went through a whole process thinking about it. And I can certainly say for me, and I feel like we kind of came to this together, that we came to this place where, you know, what's really important right now for us as Americans to say to other Americans. I mean, I feel like what we're doing here is we're talking to our people collectively. Right. And so that's Americans, that's progressives, and saying, look, we can get together on a whole lot of issues. And somehow we're not getting together nearly enough. I mean, we know, of course, we have our own little Palestine solidarity community or the peace community, whatever the various different sort of shades are. But, you know, on the whole, like sort of liberal America, progressive America is not together on this issue. In fact, it's sharply divided. And I know it seems to me, and I'm pretty sure it seems to you too, that division is based on people who are willing to really dig deep into their own principles and decide that they can put this aside for Palestine because of this reason or that reason. Sometimes it's compelling reasons. You know, it can be the history of Jewish suffering. It can be, or it can be less compelling reasons or less valid reasons, sort of just a subtle sense of, you know, Islamophobia or just sort of fear of Arab people, brown people. It can be good or bad reasons, but liberal, progressive people should not have any reason to put their principles aside on this issue. And I think that was, to me, that was what this book was meant to speak to say, look, there's room for differences of opinion on a lot of things, but principally, we should all be able to agree that Palestinians should have rights, the same rights as Israelis and everyone else. And it doesn't seem like we all do agree on that. So I think for us who are both, you know, not Palestinian, not Israeli, both American, I think for me, that was the most important thing we could try and really break open for folks. And I think this book, and certainly from the responses we've been getting so far, it seems like we're doing it.
No, we're absolutely doing it. I'm so proud of what we've managed to do so far. You know, obviously, when the world reads this and we get feedback and reviews, there'll be great critique, there'll be principle critique, there'll be bad faith critiques, there'll be good faith critiques. But we'll get better as writers and as thinkers on this issue. But I'm proud that we were able to put out a text that really does, as you said, speak to Americans about American policy, because that's a big part of this. You know, one of the interesting places that I think the book goes is pointing out those contradictions, right? And for those that don't know, Except for Palestine is partly a play on what's known in the activist community as PEPs, people who are progressive except for Palestine. Those people who are progressive except for Palestine are people who are sort of identified for this sort of interesting diversion from otherwise consistent politics, at least on their face. One of the things we talk about in the book, for example, is this idea of Donald Trump. Right before the fall 2018 midterm elections, Donald Trump is on Twitter and he's doing the Donald Trump thing. He is talking about the growing immigrant threat stemming from the southern border. And he's talking about the caravan of immigrants coming from Central America. He called it an invasion, though. And he said that they were criminals, there were terrorists. And of course, progressives stood up. They said this is wrong. They expressed sympathy for the people who were fleeing persecution, who were desperately trying to find a different life, who were trying to make their family better, make themselves better. And they also responded to Trump's immigration policy in similar fashion. Like, look, this stuff is awful. That's what you'd expect from progressives. But what was weird is, In that the summer of the same year, Trump decided to cut off funding for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency. That's the agency that provides emergency food, shelter, medication, supplies, education to millions of Palestinian refugees who are living in the West Bank, who are living in Gaza, or who are dispersed in places like Jordan or Lebanon, just or Syria and other places in neighboring countries. And as a result, people were going to have less school, less quality health care. People were going to eat less. People were going to die because of these cuts. And no one said a mumbling word. Yeah. That, for me, is stunning. And what's interesting is Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico, it's not the same as Palestine, right, but it's actually much easier to say, look, cutting off refugee funding, cutting off food for a two-year-old refugee baby is bad, right? At least in the United States, you got nativism, you got racism, you got anxieties about jobs. All of it is bad and wrong. But I can at least imagine why an American may have an anxiety about someone in the southern border coming up because of the racism that's been embedded into our consciousness through the media, et cetera. But this is fairly low-hanging fruit. This is a low-stakes outrage.
Yeah.
And yet we said nothing, Mitchell. And I think for me, that's emblematic of the kind of politics that we're wrestling with today on this question of Palestine.
Yeah, and it comes back to the idea that when we're dealing with this question, that Israel is exceptional. And I think it's important also to make that sort of connection, right? I think people often think of it as, you know, well, we have to think about Israel differently because it's in a quote unquote rough neighborhood, which is fraught, a fraught statement in its own way. And of course, is a convenient way of divorcing the United States from our own complicity as to why the Arab world continues to be run
by dictatorships. We help build that neighborhood.
But we don't think about it that way. We do think about Israel being in sort of in the midst of it. And I think it's important that we turn that around. And that's why I think the title of the book is so reflective of what we're doing, because the title does reflect, as you said, about the PEPs and the individual and the people who we're talking to here. But it also reflects the paradigm. The idea that we treat Israel differently because it's the world's only Jewish state or because it's in perpetual conflict. And again, we don't ask, why is it in perpetual conflict? How do we contribute to that? How does Israel's own policies contribute to that? So we constantly say why Israel should be an exception. And what that turns into in reality is that the real exception is Palestine, not Israel. The real exception, when we think about what's most fundamental, human rights, the basic rights that we all take for granted, that's what's exceptional. It is the Palestinians who don't have that. Israelis have that. Even to some extent, Palestinian citizens of Israel, despite, you know, some intense discrimination, they do have at least civil rights. They can go to court. You know, they get services. They can vote, etc. That whole sort of different layering of oppressions that happens, well, you know, the sort of top layer, I guess, or the least oppressed layer, I guess you would say, is Palestinian citizens of Israel. At least they do have certain rights guaranteed to them as just by being citizens of a state. Palestinians, as the rest of the Palestinian people, as stateless people, the people in the West Bank and the people in Gaza have no rights. So that is what is exceptional. And the fact that we tolerate that as Americans is, I think, central to everything that happens there, because Israel could not do this for all of this time without American support. And that's where we're culpable. So we have a responsibility. It's not an easy thing to change this kind of policy in the United States. I certainly understand that. I've been at this for 20 years. I get how difficult that is. But the exceptionalism with which we look at Palestinian rights is kind of mind-boggling. We just don't consider the idea that we're talking about people who, because of us, not entirely because of us, obviously, you know, Israel obviously is very responsible for this as well, as are other actors, not just Israel and the United States. We can talk historically about actually many European countries, but certainly the United Kingdom. The United Nations has failed this issue. We can talk about many, many people who are responsible. But the fact of the matter is we're looking here at a situation where people do not have any rights, zero. And somehow that is something we tolerate on a day-to-day basis. It's normal in our politics. Not only is it normal, it's normal to support it positively. One day after another, the easiest thing to happen in Congress is a statement of support for Israel. You know, to my mind, that is insane.
You know, this right to exist question is one of the things we take up in the book. And of course, it's the thing that we put our the most energy and time into correcting and editing and making sure we got the argument tight. the first thing I would say is Jewish people around the country, around the world, and certainly in Israel, have a right to exist, to live in peace, safety, self-determination, and dignity, and with justice. In our book, we affirm that. The question is not, do people have a right to exist in, with safety, self-determination, justice, and dignity, but do countries have a right to exist in that way? What does it mean to recognize a country's right to exist? And is that ask being made of all countries? And is this demand being made of all Palestinians? And are Palestinians willing to respect that right? You know, one of the things we see often said in diplomatic circles, at least in American political circles, really, is if only the Palestinians would recognize Israel's right to exist. And it's like, well, Palestinians have recognized Israel's right to exist at various stages in history, in the 60s, certainly in, by the time you get to the 1980s, by the time you get to 1988 in particular, with the Palestinian Declaration of Independence, Yasser Arafat's public statements. And then when you get to the Oslo Accords, which is a watershed moment in Palestinian and Israeli history, there were very clear letters written, the letters of mutual recognition, in which the Palestinians affirmed Israel's right to exist and exist as a Jewish state even. I mean, Yasser Arafat specifically said that there'd be a Jewish state. And so there hasn't been a lack of recognition. So when we say right to exist, Mitchell, what are we talking about? And why is it important to have this conversation? At the same time, again, that we do affirm the territorial integrity and recognize the existence of Israel and recognize the need to protect and safeguard all human beings around the planet, but certainly with no exception for Jewish people around the world, and certainly not in the state of Israel.
I actually want to start by kind of personalizing this question about anti-Semitism and how that's involved in the question of Israel's right to exist. I mean, for me, this hits home in a very personal way. I grew up an Orthodox Jew. I faced violent anti-Semitism growing up. I wore a kippah, so I was identifiable as Jewish. As a small child, I could not go outside. I grew up in a housing project, and there was a playground right outside, literally right outside the door. I could not play in it. The one time I tried, I was ganged up on. So that was just not happening. You know, I still have very searing memories of my brother coming home one night just bleeding profusely from his mouth because he had been attacked for being Jewish. I have been assaulted on numerous occasions. So I grew up in anti-Semitic violence, and I understand what it is, and I do not take it lightly. And I feel that many of the people who talk so much about this talk about, oh, well, you know, when somebody talks about Palestinians or brings up BDS, these kind of things, oh, I feel so threatened. This is anti-Semitism. This is horrible. I'm just, you know, for me, it's like, you don't know what anti-Semitism is. You know, certainly I'm not the only person who has experienced this. Many, many Jews have experienced far worse, but it's personal. It's a personal question to me. And for those personal reasons, I am more, shall I say, even reactionary to anti-Semitism than I am to racism, to misogyny, to homophobia, transphobia, many things causes that I'm deeply involved with and care about very deeply, but it's not directed at me. So when this question of anti-Semitism gets tied up in the question of Palestinian rights, on some level for me, it's deeply problematic in a number of different ways. And I think it's really, really important for particularly progressive Jews to be able to hold on to fighting against anti-Semitism while also fighting for Palestinian rights. So that to me is absolutely key. Now, you know, the question of the right to exist, I mean, I'm in complete agreement with you that the question of any state's quote unquote right to exist is deeply problematic. And for the most part, we don't really pursue it with any other country but Israel.
Right.
Now, Israel's advocates say that's because no other country's legitimacy is questioned, which is, I think, so clearly nonsense, especially in the sort of post-colonial era where we talk about the history of the United States constantly. Now, obviously, by questioning the genocidal roots of the initial colonization of the United States, and then, of course, the building of the country with slave labor and the genocide that accompanied just creating that industry and bringing people here across the ocean to live for generations as slaves, and the legacy of that we have not even really begun to reckon with. We talk about that all the time. And nobody says, well, you can't talk about the, you know, while people don't like it and people are still arguing that we should not have to, you know, that our children should not have to learn our actual history. Nobody's saying that by doing this, we're trying to destroy America, or at least not too many people are saying that. But with Israel, it's constant. And that, again, is a double standard. And Israel has to, I think, reckon with its own past. You know, the ambition behind Zionism was to create a state that was, quote unquote, according to Herzl, like any other. So if it's going to be like any other, then we can ask these questions. The exceptionalism, I think that we touch on this in the book, the idea of an exception for Israel is, again, based on Jewish history. Well, that is an interesting proposition, and it's an important point, one I relate to. I think one thing that I've always tried to tell people when they talk about or ask the question of why Israel has the kinds of policies and attitudes towards Palestinians that they do, what are they so afraid of? I said, well, look at World War II. And I know the Holocaust. Well, it's not just the Holocaust. It's not just that happened. It's that the entire world shut its doors. Jews have a long history of going from one place to another to escape persecution. And in World War II, we had nowhere to go, including the United States, which slammed its doors shut, you know, despite the fact that they really needed the help. They still didn't want Jews here. So I understand where that fear comes from. Okay. And all of that, we can talk about how that might justify a Jewish state, but none of that affects the idea that whatever our history is and whatever our rights are, whatever the world thinks it owes us is fine. That's all one subject. But that subject has to end where other people's rights begin. And I think that's the part that's gotten lost here. So when we're asking the question, does Israel have a right to exist? The real question that's being asked is not, does it have a right to exist? We're asking, does it have a right to exist in a manner that dispossesses and oppresses another people? And I think if we understand that, that's really the question.
Right. Because ultimately, the goal, and I think Noda Adakat said this in some form or fashion, another brilliant scholar, shared land is not a problem. The problem is that one has to relinquish the desire to rule over the other. But a shared land and a shared peace, in my estimation, is the only way forward. But that can't happen if there are laws that privilege one group over another, if there are conditions that are unsustainable for the vulnerable.
Just really quick before you move on from that, I mean, that also touches on the other aspect that you brought up, which is Palestinian acknowledgement. When Israel demands that Palestinians, and uniquely Palestinians, not just recognize Israel's right to exist, not just recognize Israel's sovereignty, but recognize its right to exist as a Jewish state, which is something that no one else, Israel itself does not ask of anyone else, and no other country has ever asked other countries to recognize its right to exist as a whatever state. When Israel asks that of Palestinians, what Israel is saying is, we want you to admit that we had the right to do this to you. Now, we can think about all kinds of futures and solutions and how do we resolve these conflicts, and we can talk about all of these things. That's fine. And there's no way to turn back the clock. There's no way to erase the injustices that were done. There's no way to bring back the people that have been killed or healed, those that are maimed on Israeli and Palestinian. We can't do any of that. But if we want to be able to move forward at all, that just cannot happen if we're asking one side to say all of this stuff that happened to us that you did was really our fault, which is essentially what that question is asking Palestinians to say. They're asking Palestinians to say, you had every right to do this to us. And that's absurd. It is inhuman. And it's also completely impractical. It cannot possibly lead to any solution of any kind.
Right. And there's a long history of Zionist thinking that would share your perspective. Even people with whom we may have an ideological discussion, even Zev Jabotinsky, right? You're talking about revisionist Zionist movement being kind of anchored in his ideology and practice, saying, you know, would have made the same argument that he didn't expect Palestinians to lay down. He didn't expect Palestinians, you know, and that it would be unrealistic to expect any group of people mm-hmm. to sort of line up for their own dislocation, their own dispossession. Let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump. Because
do we have to?
I know. But look, I mean, doesn't it feel good though? We can say like former President Donald Trump.
Former president really does sound good. It's true.
Yeah. So, and when we wrote this book, Donald Trump was president and we weren't sure that he wouldn't not be president. Right.
Right.
So it was one of those things like we have to assume. In fact, in some ways, I would argue we probably assume that he would be. And one of the chapters in the book is called Trumped Up Policy. And it's about Donald Trump. It's a fun one, I think, because it really forces us to be honest with ourselves, but also to kind of reflect on American policy over the last 20 years. And basically, it's tempting to think of Donald Trump as the boogeyman. And he is. This is Mark talking and only Mark. He is a piece of human garbage. So I am totally comfortable saying that, you know, Donald Trump is responsible for all kinds of awfulness. But in many ways, having a boogeyman, a monstrous figure like Donald Trump can let us off the hook. It can mm-hmm. it can allow us to believe that everything was fine until he came, or that getting back to normal will be acceptable. Getting back to normal is not okay if, you know, you're among the working poor, if you don't have health insurance. Getting back to the pre-Trump norm isn't okay if you're getting hit with a predator drone in Yemen or Somalia. Back to normal is only okay for a very small slice of people. And on the question of Israel-Palestine, the Trump administration, again, can be seen as an outlier in certain ways. And there are a few things that Trump did that were a little bit different, you know, acknowledging, recognizing the Golan Heights as Israeli land is something different. Post-World War I, one of the things post-World War I life was about was saying, hey, this whole taking people's land by force thing, not really cool. Like, I'm not saying imperialism doesn't happen anymore, but you know, in general, you can't just take stuff and keep it and then move in and transfer your population onto it. And that's why the Golan has been contested. That's why international consensus around the West Bank is what it is. But Trump says, you know what? It's Israel's. And that's out of step. Bush didn't do that. Clinton didn't do that. Obama didn't do that. Reagan didn't do that. But on most issues, Donald Trump is like American policy on steroids. It's not that he's something different. He's of the same sort. He's just a more aggressive and deodorized version of that policy, you know? So, for example, many people around the world were very frustrated that Donald Trump moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And part of the reason for that is because it came with what accompanied that was a recognition of Jerusalem as the undivided capital of Israel. East Jerusalem, of course, was taken in the 1967 war. It was captured in the 1967 war. Let me back up. In 1948, East Jerusalem was occupied or controlled by Jordan. And then in the 1967 war, what some call the Six-Day War, we saw it go from Jordanian occupation to Israeli occupation. But East Jerusalem has always been a site of, for Palestinians, it was seen as a future capital of a Palestinian state. Mm-hmm. At the very least, as people negotiate one-state solutions, two-state solutions, three-state solutions, the idea was that Jerusalem would be one of those things that would get figured out in the final status. It'd be one of those things that would get worked out in the end. And so what Donald Trump did was say, wait a minute, no, I'm recognizing this. Despite what the international community says, despite what international law says, I say, you know what, Jerusalem is the capital. And so you say, oh, there's another example of Trump being the boogeyman. There's another example of Trump being the outlier. But it's not really true, because while Trump did move the embassy or allow for the embassy to be moved, the embassy itself could legally be moved since 1995. There's something called the Jerusalem Embassy Act, which was signed in mm-hmm. 1995. Was that June of 95?
I believe so. I think it was June 95.
Yeah. And the Jerusalem Embassy Act was signed, which allowed for the U.S. Embassy to move there. And again, as a way of recognizing Jerusalem as the undivided capital of Israel. Now, here's what's interesting, particularly for my younger listeners. In 1995, Donald Trump wasn't president. He was still making terrible casinos. He wasn't even making terrible reality shows yet. You know who was president in 1995? A guy named William Jefferson Blythe Clinton, a Democrat. And so if Clinton, a Democratic president, was there when the Jerusalem Embassy Act was signed, and a Congress pushed it and he didn't fight it, he didn't attempt to veto it. In fact, he kind of, I don't want to go so far as to say he campaigned on it, but it was almost like a double dog dare from the right to say who's going to go farthest on this issue. Ultimately, Clinton was okay with it.
He was, although he didn't sign the act. And he, it was actually October of 95. I just looked it up, actually.
Thank you, October.
But, and he made sure that, you know, and Congress went along with this, the idea, and I'm sure you're about to go there, the presidential waiver. Yeah,
yes.
That went there for, yeah, that every president enacted until Trump didn't.
And that's what's interesting about it, right? So what Bill Clinton kind of let it lay there like a pierogi on a plate, right? He's, you know, he doesn't veto it. He doesn't sign it. It makes it through. And what happens? But there's a waiver that allows whoever is in office to kick this down the field for another 6 months. And so mm-hmm. basically what has happened from 1995 until 2018, right? Because mm-hmm. it was 70 years after Israeli independence mm-hmm. is every 6 months for the for the last 23 years, the president just signs the waiver. It's like on autopilot. It's like paying your cable bill or your cell phone bill through autopay. It just happens, right? And here's why this is important. Bill Clinton gets to say that this happened under his watch. The Congress gets to say it happened under their watch. nobody wants to be look like they're soft on the issue, so no one's going to fight back on it. They all just keep signing the waiver, so everybody's okay. So Trump didn't actually change U.S. policy. He just didn't sign the waiver.
Right.
He just allowed U.S. policy to actually come into full bloom.
Right.
And so instead of looking at Trump as the outlier or the boogeyman or the monster, the point is that there has been consistent bipartisan support, or at least indifference at times, mm-hmm. for these policies. And so we wanted to, in this book, make sure that Trump is not seen. We can say, look, Trump is terrible in all these ways. But to solve the question of Israel-Palestine, we're going to need to do more than just vote Donald Trump out of office.
Sure. And the proof of that is actually, if you look at Joe Biden and his first few weeks in office, he has moved to reverse Trump's policies on immigration. He has at least tried to set a different tone on various issues that were...
Immigration, Muslim ban, all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he's tried to set a different tone on the racial issues that so gripped us for a while and seemed to have just not changed at all. He's issued a whole bunch of executive orders on a lot of different He is working at least to try and get us back into the Iran nuclear deal. He's clearly struck a different tone with Saudi Arabia. We just saw some of the results of that just yesterday. There's a lot that's changed. Well, what's changed with Israel?
He's actually said he's not going to move the embassy back.
He's
right?
not going to move the embassy back. He has Secretary of State Antony Blinken has skillfully dodged the question of the Golan Heights when he's been directly asked. He's just refused to answer, which I think is a pretty strong indication that they have no intention of reversing that either. They are working to try and restore funds to some funds to the Palestinians, but that is actually, you know, there's actually real hurdles to that. Once those funds were stripped, it because, again, of longstanding laws and some that are just a few years old, it's hard to restore those just by executive action. But he hasn't exactly put it, you know, on the top of his priority list. As a matter of fact, very little has changed. Even in terms of rhetoric, Biden has not said he intends to change a great many things. So I think we see right away that, yeah, he might not. I don't think Biden would have ever recognized the Golan outside of an agreement between Israel and Syria. I don't think Biden would have moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. But now that it's been done, he's not going to reverse it. And again, it's because it is actually just an extension of longstanding bipartisan policy. And as a result, he may realize that maybe, yeah, these were not the smartest things to do. These were not really moves that were in our interest. But he knows that he's not going to get into the political fight it would take to reverse that. And the reason that it would be such a political fight is not because AIPAC is so strong. It is because these issues are deeply embedded in American policy for decades.
That is exactly right. And that's the point of the book in many ways, right? It's that, again, Palestine becomes exceptional. Biden is saying, I'm going to undo everything Trump did, except this thing over here.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there'll be others. You know, I don't mean to suggest that Biden is only leaving this issue out, but this is a biggie. And he's not even pretending to be that different on it.
Even, you know, we can even look at the fact that, sure, it's sort of understandable, at least expected, that when Biden won the election, Netanyahu was going to quickly rush to get as many new settlements approved in the West Bank as possible, which is what he did. And Biden was silent and has remained silent. He has not said anything about trying to reverse those. Or, you know, he wants to revive the peace process and he wants to revive the idea that a two-state solution is still viable. So he has made statements about no further expansions and don't do more. But construction going on in Givat HaMatos and very sensitive areas that clearly make a two-state solution impossible. He's not taking it on. He's not fighting that fight, and it's a fight he could win. If he's fighting in the name of a two-state solution, it is a fight that Democrats would have to get behind, but he's not. They only have to get behind it if the president leads them that way. And he's not going to do that because it will be a political fight. And it would be a political fight that would be in the name of reversing sort of gifts given to Israel, and that's not how our policy operates.
I ask authors this. It's a little weird because, you know, we're both on the same project here. But who's the audience for this in your mind? Who do you want to read this?
I think in terms of a really broad audience. And so I think in this instance, I think in terms of liberal Americans, right? That's the first thing I think of. But recently, once the release date of the book started getting close,
yeah.
And we mostly you, but both of us have seen our fair share of attacks on social media. Yeah, one of the things I've been doing is kind of looking at who are these people launching the attacks. So, you know, when I see it on Twitter, I click on them just to, you know, look at their little one sentence bios. And I've been stunned by how many people, especially people specifically attacking you in ways that I consider highly disrespectful, ways that are different from me. And I have to think that that at least part of that difference has to do with race.
For sure.
And I'm seeing people with Black Lives Matter in their bio. So more than anyone else, I think it's those people. Now, they're attacking you, they're attacking us based on not having read the book. And they may not read the book. I hope they do, though, because I those are exactly the people who would be great to see what happens when they actually engage with the arguments rather than with who they think you or I are. And their mistaken notions of that and the assumptions they make about things. I mean, most of these people are saying, well, you're just spending this whole book attacking Israel. And most certainly we're critical of Israel in this book. I would not play that down at all. We are certainly critical. But I also think that we are taking a very analytical approach here. And I think that we look at why Israel has the policies it does. And I think for me, one of the things that I want to get across is that if you think Israel's policies are bad, you should recognize that they are only that bad because the United States shields them from consequences. Any state would have, no matter how democratic or whatever you want to call it, any state that does not have to face consequences for its actions is going to have bad policies with people it is in conflict with, no matter how imbalanced or balanced or no matter what the nature of that conflict is. You know, the United States itself acts the same way in many places around the world. And because of the cover we give to Israel, Israel does the same. And so it really does come back here. So these are the people I want to see it. The ones who think that they are anti-racist, but somehow can defend this horrible example of ethnic oppression.
Absolutely. Mitchell, I know we got to run soon, but I wanted to at least get your sense of what people should be reading. You know, there are a lot of people who say, look, I'd love to know more about Israel, Palestine, and I'd love to understand the history. I'm not even at a place where I can make an argument one way or the other. I just want to learn some stuff. And so I figured one of the things we could do is maybe nerd out for just a minute or two and give people some great books to start. I'm going to throw out a few myself, but I want to get a sense. And I think there are classic books, but I actually think that there are some new books out that are a good place to start for understanding the sort of what people call the conflict. I'm actually going to say, and this is something that a lot of people might surprise people, I actually find that the very basic introduction book series and the introduction to Palestine, you know, a lot of times those books aren't good on topics like the introduction to car making or car making for dummies, you know. But sometimes in terms of understanding like names and dates and years and stuff like that, I do think there is some value sometimes in reading certain books. And so there's a book called The Palestine-Israel Conflict, A Basic Introduction by, I believe it's Gregory Harms and Todd Ferry. Mm-hmm. I think that is a very strong backdrop. Again, I don't want to pretend that any book in the history of the universe is neutral, but I do think there's something to be said about giving people just a basic backdrop of history, you know, in terms of just even basic things like understanding the Ottoman Empire and what it meant to go from Ottoman rule to British rule, what it meant, what the Balfour Declaration is. And of course, as people who study this for a living, you know, you and I may read five books just on the Balfour Declaration, you know what I mean, to analyze a particular line of the 67-word letter. Whereas, you know, for other people, just reading something to explain what the Balfour Declaration is incredibly important, or the Husseini-McMahon correspondence, or, you know, any of these things, you know, giving people a kind of backdrop. I'm going to name just a couple more that I think are pretty neat books. One actually came out more recently. It's by Ilan Pepe. This is for people, particularly people who are activists. And of course, Ilan Pepe is one of the great historians of Israel-Palestine and specifically of this issue. And he's written a great wide range of books, from the ethnic cleansing of Palestine to the biggest prison on earth to the more kind of traditional text, A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples. All those books are great, but the book that I was actually thinking about is his newer book. It's called 10 Myths About Israel. because one of the things that book does is it's very accessible. The book is called 10 Myths About Israel. It came out in 2017. And what the book does is it breaks down some of the big myths about Israel-Palestine that many people are engaged in, people who have started to study the issue and they want to know a little bit more. For example, the idea that Palestine was empty during the Balfour Declaration of 1917. Of course, it was not empty. Or the idea that Palestinians just got up and left their homes in 1948. Or the idea that the 1967 war was not a defensive or preemptive war, but rather was a war of no choice. These are the kinds of things that get raised, you know, because you'll hear the same, even on Twitter, you'll hear the same debates over and over again about why the Camp David Accords failed, about why the Clinton Accords failed. And getting into that stuff is super important. But again, I understand that some people can't get into the weeds and spend years reading this stuff, although I think it's hella interesting and worth it. And so I'm saying a book like 10 Myths About Israel is another great place to start. I'll give one more, and then I'll pass this over to you. Actually, two more. One is, and I hope I'm not stepping on your toes here, but again, I think the work of Rashid Khalidi is incredibly important. Of course, a historian at Columbia University, he's written many books, including his most recent book, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance from 1917 to 2017. I think that's a wonderful book. And again, if you want a kind of quick and dirty, and I mean that in the best sense of that phrase, analysis of what's happened over the last 100 years or over the 100-year period from 1917, again, from the Balfour Declaration into 2017, I think that's great. But the book that I actually like, that I think is super interesting, is Palestinian Identity, The Construction mm-hmm. of Modern National Consciousness, which helps people really think through sort of how Palestinian develops as an identity and as a social movement, as part of a quest for statehood and independence. It's a super important book. And then the book that I really like, and this was a book that was really an anchor for me, again, as part of my early reading, was Tom Segev's book, One Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, One Palestine Complete. Yeah.
One Palestine Complete. I was forgetting a word. Mm-hmm. That I think that's an incredibly important book
yep.
that helps people think about so many things, including giving, a rich and deep history. And it's really interesting to think about what it means for him to write that book in a way that I think is compelling, that's readable, accessible, and that's not so deeply ideological that you feel like you're not getting a kind of full analysis of what's going on. Mitchell, would you add anything to that list?
Well, I mean, yeah, you certainly took a couple that I was thinking of. And One Palestine Complete, I would also just want to add that one of the things that is so wonderful about that book is it goes back into the early days of Zionist immigration and shows that in some cases, at least, that when Jews from Europe got there and found that, you know, indeed there were people already there, they actually found ways to get along and to start building community out. Obviously, events, you know, overtook those efforts and they were never the dominant strain. But to me, it becomes very clear when you read that book that the idea that Israeli Jews or European Jews and Palestinians can't get along is just not true. It's proven not to be the case. So a few books that I would recommend, if you're interested in just a really raw, just a text, something that's academic, that is really dispassionate and really just gives you a full history, just the facts. I really like Palestine and the Arab-Israeli Conflict by Charles Smith. It's got tons of documentation. It's a great reference for it. So if you're planning to start on a book that is sort of a basis for a lot of further reading, that is a great one because it really does give you the history. It gives you the perspectives of multiple different sides, but really focuses on making sure that you know the history from a Palestinian point of view and from an Israeli point of view. And I think that's something that's really important. Rashid Khalidi, his books are all brilliant. I mean, it's amazing. But there's one that I think is really valuable, particularly for activists, when you're asked, well, why don't you ever critique the Palestinian side? Why don't you ever hold Palestinians accountable for the mistakes they made? And Palestinians, it is true, yes, they have faced incredible disruption from the British, from the Americans, and then finally from the Israelis. And all of that's true, but they've also had some really bad leadership over the years. And Rashid Khalidi's book, The Iron Cage, explores this very,
yes,
very well.
Yes, yes.
You know, without ever saying this is really why it's not the fault of the international community, it's not the fault of the Israelis. He never, you can never get that out of his book. no matter how you twist it, he is very clear about holding accountable people who need to be accountable. But he's also saying, you know, look, as a Palestinian, he's saying, look, we as Palestinians have to also be self-critical. And this is the things we need to address historically, things that have not gone the way that they could have or should have, and that might have made a real difference. So on the historical level, the one other book of history that's sort of history that I'd really recommend is one that's a little more obscure. It's by a man named Lawrence Silberstein, and it's called The Post-Zionism Debates. And it's actually debates about Zionism that go back to the original founders of Zionism and how it developed over a long period of time. And I think that gives people some really good insight into how an ideology developed into what it became from a place that was actually kind of idealistic. It's hard to imagine when you see Israeli policies today, but there was an idealism, you know, relatively speaking, for 19th century Europe. So that perspective should not be lost. But still, that idealism came into a clash with pure nationalism. And another book along those lines is Zev Sternhell's book, The Founding Myths of Israel, where he makes the case that whenever nationalism and socialism came into conflict, nationalism always won. And that really tells you a lot about how Israeli policy developed. More recently, Nour Erekat's book, Justice for Some, when you want to talk about, you know, years ago, I remember an activist from Jewish Voice of Peace, which was the first place I worked in this field, came to me and was talking about how international law is so important to everything that we're doing in terms of Palestinian rights. And I said, you know, frankly, I'm not sure international law is really the be all and end all. It's a useful tool, but it's got its flaws. And Nora makes a very similar case in her book.
Right.
And I think that's a really, really important point for people to take with them. Also, Khaled Al-Gindi's recent book from 2019, Blind Spot, really shines a light on the whole fairly sordid history of U.S. policy towards this whole conflict. And I think it kind of brings us more up to date in a very policy-oriented sort of framework that is really informative and also a really good read.
Oh, man, these are great books. And hopefully you all are taking notes. And of course, all these books can be purchased through Uncle Bobby's. You can go to bookshop.org/shop/Uncle Bobby's and grab all of these books.
And if you go to the back room at Uncle Bobby's and you look by the couch that's right by the big window there, there's a coffee stand on the couch. That's mine.
That is true. That is very, very true. All right. I got one more thing for you before we go. Now, I had a guest host when I did my last book. I have been subjected to this game as well. This is a game that my guests play, and it brings me great joy.
Uh-oh. I'm scared now. It's not basketball.
Fortunately not. It brings me great joy. It brings them great pain.
I imagine. Yeah, I thought that was where we were going.
Yeah. This game is called Buy It, Borrow It, or Burn It. I'm going to name three books. One you can buy, one you can borrow, and one you burn.
Burning books. Okay.
I know. And of course, as I always say, we don't actually advocate the burning of books. We simply love to be a jerk to our guests. The first one is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. The second book is called Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine by Nour Erekat. And the third book, to make it even more complicated and challenging, is Orientalism by Edward Said.
You're going to ask me to burn one of these books. Okay, so all three of these are books I absolutely love from people. I never met Edward Said. I know Khaled and Nour. So two people I absolutely love and one who's like a ridiculous hero to me. That's just, oh my God, that is just mean, man. That is really, really mean.
That's what I like to hear.
Oh God, Nero's going to come in. I'm going to have to say that you buy Orientalism because you got to keep coming back to that book forever. It remains so amazingly relevant. It really is timeless. And
just for people to know, Orientalism is written by Edward Said. It is in many ways, I would say, a foundational text for Middle East studies.
Yes.
For literary theory, for cultural criticism.
For any area studies.
Post-colonial studies.
Yep.
Right. Area studies. I mean, it has really changed how we understand the world, how we understand and critique the West. There's so many layers and levels. If there's a single book that you need to have, if you're going to engage in this work or any work adjacent to it, get Edward Said's Orientalism. But go ahead. So you're going to buy that.
So I'm going to buy that one. I'm in so much trouble here. You would have to come up with authors who actually know me and know where I live, even. I mean, yes. Okay. All right. I'm borrowing Khalid's book, Blind Spot. And Noura, you know how much I love you. Please don't kill me. But yeah, that I guess that one's going to go to Burb only because it's just more narrowly focused on law. That's the only reason that one goes out there. And that's only fair. Because, and at that, only because Mark made me. So if you're going to get mad at anybody, get mad at him.
That's fair. I'll take all the heat. Although you're the one putting Nora's book in the fire. No, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine.
And she is not somebody I want to be on the wrong side of, really.
I think that's right. But Nora has offered a powerful critique of law and international law.
Yeah, it's a really great book.
It's a wonderful book.
Get it before Mark burns it. Yeah, absolutely.
That's exactly right. And Khaled's book is also a great analysis that's deeply steeped in history as well. I think all three are important books. I would encourage all three books to be purchased. And of course, I want you to purchase Mia Mitchell's new book. It's called Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. You can get this book anywhere books are sold by the time you hear our voice. And you can get all the books again at Uncle Bobby's. You can go to UncleBobby's.com. That's Uncle BOBBIES.com. You can also go to bookshop.org/shop/UncleBobby's to grab all this stuff. Mitchell, you are now a famous author. People, you're going to be in high demand for speeches, for analysis, for all kinds of stuff. How can people find you?
As we say, from your mouth to God's ears. People can find me on Twitter at MJ Plitnik. You can find me at my website, rethinkingforeignpolicy.org. If you can't remember that, mitchellplitnik.com will also get you there. And if you're interested in following my work more closely, you can sign up for my newsletter at Substack. So it's mitchellplitnik.substack.com.
Mitchell, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be reaching out to you because you're brilliant, you're wonderful. And other than being a Brooklyn Nets fan, you are an extraordinary human being.
Man, we are going to get down in the playoffs, you and me. We are. Yeah. Even if we have to do it from a distance, but oh man, I am going to enjoy watching you suffer as KD, Kyrie, and James Harden just bury three after three over Joel Embiid.
It is stunning that someone can be so committed to justice and peace and dignity all around the world, but he becomes a monster when it comes to basketball. You'll see just how much in the playoffs when my team wins. But anyway, everybody, thanks for hanging out with us. We'll see you next week. Peace. Coffee and Books is a production of Embassy Row. Our executive producer is Sarnie Rogers. This episode was produced by Karis Nelson. The show was edited by Maureen Bigas. And you can follow me on Instagram at Mark Lamont Hill and the show on Instagram at Coffee and Books Show. Catch you next week.